In May 1917, Sir William Wiseman, the chief of British intelligence in New York, wrote to his superiors in London that the Germans have managed to secure control of the most important secret societies in Russia, and it is necessary that this German influence should be exposed and counter-societies organized if necessary. It must not be forgotten that the Russian people are accustomed to regard their secret societies as the most important part of their liberal political machinery. Wiseman recorded this shortly after the Russian Tsar had fallen, and only months before the Bolsheviks would seize power. Wiseman was correct about what was happening. He rightly sensed that it wasn't just Russia's fate at stake, but the fate of the world. A few months earlier, the French physician and occultist Gerard Ancaus had predicted something similar. Known as Papus, he'd formerly served as a spiritual advisor to the Russian imperial family, a role since assumed by the infamous Grigory Rasputin. Along with being an occultist, Papus was a secret agent of the French government. He worked to ensure the Russo-French alliance remained intact. He was also an emissary of French Freemasonry in the organization of Russian lodges. Not just any Freemasonry, but the mystical and political French Martinist variety. An associate remarked that the social program Papus entrusted to his Russian brethren was nothing less than the germ of Sovietism. Papus himself said it was through the Russian Martinists that the plan of the Russian Revolution would be defined. Another key player in this story was the Russian-born Marxist revolutionary Alexander Helpand, known as Parvus, who'd spent much of his life in Germany. Parvus was a friend and mentor to the future Bolshevik activist Leon Trotsky. In early 1915, Parvus appeared at the German embassy in Constantinople to propose a plan. Germany and Russia were at war. Parvus argued that Russian revolutionaries in Germany had a common aim, the destruction of Tsarism and the division of Russia into smaller states. German money could help the revolutionaries achieve this end. Parvus offered to be Berlin's agent in organizing the subversion of Russia. But Papus's scheming would have nothing to do with the coming fall of the Tsar. He was beaten to the punch by another conspiracy hatched by liberal members of Russia's parliament, or Duma. It was no coincidence that every single one of these liberal plotters was a Freemason. Most were brothers of a single lodge, the so-called Grand Orient of the Peoples of Russia. These Masonic lodges were the secret societies British intelligence agent Wiseman was talking about in his message to London. The Russian Empire of 1917 had almost 180 million inhabitants, but fewer than 1,000 Masons. Political Masons, of which the Grand Orient was the biggest bunch, numbered maybe 400. They used the lodge as a vehicle for political organization and agitation as opposed to fellowship and enlightenment. However, this seemingly insignificant group counted many of Russia's most influential people, politicians, captains of industry, financiers, military officers, and even members of the Romanov family. Once the Freemason-dominated Duma forced Nicholas to abdicate, the same political Freemasons dominated the provisional government that replaced the Tsar. Over the next 8 months, almost every member of the Russian provisional government was a Masonic brother. But it would be wrong to suppose that Russia's Freemasons, least of all the political ones, were unified beyond the desire to remove Nicholas from the throne. Still, this tiny fraternity dominated almost every corner of Russian politics. For instance, the leaders of the socialist-only Petrograd Soviet were also mostly Masons. Among them was the man who became the most important figure in the provisional government, moderate socialist and Freemason Alexander Kerensky. Among the rival Bolsheviks, much the same was true. Lenin, Trotsky, and many others had belonged to lodges at one time or another. But such Freemasons didn't seek political power to pursue a Masonic agenda. They used Freemasonry to pursue political ones. Because the Bolsheviks would be the winners of the Russian Revolutionary Sweepstakes, and that victory would hugely impact history, they deserve close scrutiny. But you might already be thinking, wait, the Bolsheviks were a political movement, not a secret society. Lenin and his comrades were tough-minded Marxists who didn't go in for things like secret handshakes and mystical mumbo-jumbo. Weren't they? Well, under the basic definition of a secret society, selective recruitment, the promise of special knowledge and status, and the demand of absolute loyalty, Bolshevism and its spawn, communism, had all these characteristics. The Bolsheviks wanted to overthrow not just a government, but the entire social and economic order. And Lenin aimed beyond regime change in Russia to a revolutionary wave that would sweep the entire globe, a revolution that would culminate in a new world order. What was Bolshevism then? Basically, the Bolsheviks began as a faction of the larger Russian socialist movement. And they were a small faction. Their chief rivals were the so-called Mensheviks. Bolshevik and Menshevik roughly translate as majorityites and minorityites. However, the Bolsheviks were really the minority, and the Mensheviks were really the majority. Make sense? No, except in politics. At a socialist conference in 1903, Lenin claimed victory in various votes despite controlling only a fraction of the delegates. What proved him a great tactician was his ability to hang on to and exploit the majorityite label. One fundamental difference between Bolsheviks and Mensheviks came down to a matter of organization. Both were Marxists. This meant that they saw history as a struggle between the dominant capitalist system and the exploited working class, or proletariat. Marxists believed the proletariat was bound to triumph in the end. The question was how long and what form the revolution would take. Mensheviks favored a mass workers' party, an open organization. Lenin argued instead for a small vanguard party of committed revolutionaries who would rely on conspiratorial techniques. In other words, a political secret society as opposed to a mass political movement. In Russia, which was then an absolute monarchy, Lenin's model arguably made more sense. His mantra was flexibility in means, inflexibility in goal. Do whatever it takes. This single-mindedness probably explains why he succeeded and the Mensheviks disappeared into the dustbin of history. So who was Lenin? Well, he actually wasn't Lenin at all. His real name was Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov. Like many of his comrades, he took a revolutionary alias, mostly because it was the cool thing revolutionaries were supposed to do. Lenin's family background, as with most leading Bolsheviks, was anything but proletarian. He was a hereditary nobleman. Lenin, as undisputed leader of the Bolsheviks, displayed characteristics that we might identify with a cult leader. Bolshevism and its governing faith, Marxism-Leninism, were impossible to conceive without him. No one rose in the party or remained in it without his blessing. He preferred to be a big fish in a small pond. Prior to 1917, Lenin's only conspicuous accomplishment was splintering the Russian socialists into rival factions. This has spawned a provocative theory that in doing so, he was acting as a tool of the revolutionary's arch nemesis, the Tsarist secret police, the Okhrana. In essence, the Okhrana was a government secret society that combated revolutionary conspiracies with its own conspiracies. It's the old game of divide and conquer. The Okhrana excelled at infiltrating revolutionary groups and placing its agents in leading positions. Nothing proves that Lenin was an Okhrana agent, but it's not hard to imagine how his ambition would be useful to the Okhrana and their favor useful to him. Lenin was nothing if not a pragmatist. The lifeblood of politics is money. That point certainly didn't escape Lenin, and he was always looking for ways to get his hands on more. And he wasn't picky. You see, the Bolsheviks observed the same rule that has guided so many secret societies. To the pure, all things are pure. The ends justifies the means. The triumph of the revolution represented the ultimate good, so anything that facilitated it was sanctified by the cause. That included robbery and even murder. The boldest and bloodiest of the Bolshevik expropriations, as they called them, was the Tiflis bank robbery of June 1907. In the main square of today's Georgian capital, a Bolshevik band, among them a young Joseph Stalin, ambushed a payroll convoy and got away with more than 340,000 rubles. That amounts to nearly $4 million today. The attack also left 40 people dead and 50 injured. Such bloodletting earned the Bolsheviks cash, but cost them on the public relations front. The stolen rubles, marked bills as it turned out, proved hard to launder as well. More reliable were contributions from wealthy supporters. Among them were some of the very same capitalist exploiters the Bolsheviks aimed to destroy. Politics always makes strange bedfellows. A prime example was Sava Morozov, who belonged to the fifth richest family in Russia. The Morozovs owned textile mills, and Sava funneled some of the profits to the Bolsheviks. When his mother put a stop to it, Morozov supposedly became so despondent that he shot himself through the heart. But another version holds that the industrialist was murdered by one of Lenin's trusted brethren, an engineer, financial genius, and Freemason named Leonid Krasin. At stake was a large insurance policy. Playing a middleman role in this Morozov business was another well-heeled patron of the revolution, the writer Maxim Gorky, who was yet another Freemason. While not a Bolshevik per se, Gorky put his name and money behind Lenin. Gorky was a good friend of Sava Morozov and had persuaded the unlucky industrialist to make the insurance payable to Gorky's common-law wife, actress Maria Andreeva. She handed over the bulk of the payout, a cool 60,000 rubles, to Lenin. Gorky also visited New York on a revolutionary fundraising mission in 1906. Accompanying him, in addition to girlfriend Andreeva, was a personal secretary, Nikolai Burenin. In fact, Burenin was Lenin's secret financial agent and carried with him money recently stolen in another robbery. Burenin's real mission was to launder the purloined rubles and manage the funds Gorky raised. When Gorky arrived in the Big Apple, he was greeted by, what else, a secret society. This was the A Club, a select group of journalists, writers, and artists, including Freemason Mark Twain. They feted Gorky at a fancy dinner in Greenwich Village. But the scheme was dashed on the rocks of American prudery. Gorky and Andreeva shared a hotel room, even though they were not legally man and wife. When this inconvenient fact leaked to the press, the Russian couple became unwelcome, and Gorky's tour was a bust. Even the A Club kept its distance. This didn't end Gorky's collaboration with Lenin, however. Back in Europe, Gorky rented a villa on the Italian island of Capri. Lenin and other Bolsheviks were frequent guests and established a school at the villa to provide revolutionary training. Comrades could pursue the finer arts of propaganda and bomb-making. Another name to conjure with in the Russian Revolution is, of course, Leon Trotsky. Often labeled a Menshevik, Trotsky was a movement unto himself and did not become a Bolshevik until 1917. His rise in the revolutionary firmament began with a failed uprising dubbed the Revolution of 1905. At that time, Trotsky was a friend and protege of arch-conspirator Alexander Helpand Parvus. By 1916, he was living in France, spreading anti-war and anti-Tsarist propaganda. This created a problem because France was an ally of Tsarist Russia. So in the fall of 1916, the French government booted Trotsky to neutral Spain. His brief Spanish interlude is a strange and important one. A mysterious benefactor supplied him and his whole family with cash and first-class tickets to New York. Various clues suggest that the man behind this was his old pal, Parvus. Trotsky arrived in the Big Apple in mid-January 1917 and remained there until after the Tsar's fall that March. In New York, he immediately threw himself into socialist and anti-war politics. One story claims that when he left New York, he returned to Russia, he carried with him $10,000 and an American passport. There's no proof of either, but it's interesting that the accusation arose. Trotsky is frequently linked to American banker Jacob Schiff, a Jew and Freemason who nursed a long hatred of the anti-Semitic Tsarist regime. Schiff had funded Russian revolutionaries in 1905, and there's every reason to suppose he was willing to do so in 1917. He was also closely connected to the Warburg Bank in Germany, which in turn was closely associated with the Kaiser's government. Curiously, the head of the bank, Max Warburg, is identified in a British intelligence report as the chief German agent in Russia. One has to wonder, were Trotsky, Parvus, Schiff, and Warburg all pieces of some vast conspiracy? Or was it just coincidence? By 1917, the World War was locked in hopeless stalemate. As the likelihood of military victory evaporated, the Germans saw more opportunity in Parvus's plan of subversion in Russia. Lenin, meanwhile, cooled his heels in Switzerland. Parvus approached Lenin as early as 1915 with an offer of German money, but Lenin played hard to get, and the Germans weren't all that interested. By early 1917, Bolshevik membership had dwindled to around 10,000, less than a quarter of what it had been a decade earlier. As regards Russia and the war, Lenin was a complete defeatist. He believed that peace at any cost was necessary to advance the revolution in Russia and the world revolution to follow. That was not a popular position, even among revolutionaries. Trotsky, for instance, publicly opposed a separate peace. At least he did in March 1917. Once the Tsar fell, Lenin's chief problem was how to get out of Switzerland. France and Italy refused to assist the return to Russia of someone determined to undermine their shaky ally. Of course, the Germans were delighted to do so. A sealed train carried Lenin across Germany to Scandinavia and from there to Russia. The Kaiser's men also pledged to underwrite the Bolshevik propaganda campaign using banks and front companies set up by Parvus. A key component in this network was the Stockholm-based Nya Bank, run by socialist financier Olaf Aschberg. Aschberg was well known in New York and Berlin banking circles and was in close contact with the Bolsheviks in Stockholm. Aschberg was also a business partner of Abram Zhivotofsky, who just happened to be Leon Trotsky's uncle. But Lenin wasn't putting all his eggs in one basket. Decades later, CIA chief Alan Dulles told recruits about an early 1917 incident when he was a junior staffer in the American legation in Bern, Switzerland. One weekend that April, Dulles reluctantly answered a phone at the legation. On the other hand was an obscure Russian radical, Lenin, who wanted to arrange a meeting right away. Dulles, late for a hot date, told him to call back on Monday. Lenin sighed that it would be too late. America at this point was just days away from joining the war in Europe. What could Lenin have wanted from the Yanks? Did he contemplate betraying Parvus's schemes to leverage some kind of diplomatic protection? Regardless, Lenin beat Trotsky back to Russia. There he rallied the Bolshevik faithful with slogans of "all power to the Soviets" and "peace, land, and bread." And he unleashed a torrent of propaganda funded by German money. Bolshevik ranks mushroomed from 20,000 in April 1917 to 200,000 by late summer. In the meantime, the liberal Freemasons running the provisional government stake their fortunes on winning the war against Germany and its allies. But as Lenin, Trotsky, and many others could see, it was already lost. Russia was war-weary and its economy in shambles. And just as Parvus had predicted, the bourgeois liberals who overthrew the Tsar lacked the will or ability to follow through on genuine political and economic change. Lenin could truthfully say that he never received a kopeck from Berlin directly. Nevertheless, the provisional government's intelligence began to piece together what was going on. And in July 1917, Lenin unwisely backed an abortive effort to topple the regime. This resulted in criminal indictments against him and other Bolsheviks, eventually including Trotsky. Lenin escaped to neighboring Finland, while Trotsky and some others ended up in jail. But no prosecutions followed. One problem was proving that the German subsidies were anything more than routine business transactions. Some suspected, however, that the Masonic head of the provisional regime, Alexander Kerensky, secretly shielded the Bolsheviks because they might come in handy down the road. And so they did. Egged on by the desperate liberals, an ambitious general named Lavr Kornilov tried to seize power. Kerensky set Trotsky and the other Bolsheviks free to rally the workers against Kornilov. It worked. Kornilov's rebellion collapsed, but the Bolsheviks took all the credit. In August 1917, Lenin finally admitted Trotsky into Bolshevik ranks. This didn't go over well with other comrades, and for good reason. Lenin and Trotsky had traded insults for years. As recently as January, Lenin had branded Trotsky a Judas and opportunist. So what had brought them together? It partly was because they'd both come to the conclusion that the popular revolutionary councils, or Soviets, were the key to power. Trotsky could also see that Lenin ran a growing operation, while he mustered only a few thousand followers. Another factor might have been financial arrangements Trotsky made in New York. Regardless, Lenin now placed Judas Trotsky in charge of organizing the October Revolution. That swept aside Kerensky and established the Soviet regime. The October Revolution was really a coup d'etat, and it didn't hand the Bolsheviks full power of Russia. Mostly just the big cities like Petrograd and Moscow. Their hold on power was fragile and would not be secured until they won a bloody civil war in 1920. Lenin held that a socialist revolution in Russia could not survive without outside aid. Lenin believed this would come through a world revolution. Russia was just the spark. Germany, France, America, and the rest of the industrialized world would soon follow. It was a great theory, but it didn't materialize. There were abortive communist uprisings in Germany, Hungary, and even in Switzerland, but all fizzled. Even world revolution needed help. Still, the Bolsheviks found other allies, many in places you wouldn't imagine, like Wall Street. One example is the American mining magnate and financier William Boyce Thompson. In 1917, Thompson headed the American Red Cross mission to Russia. The mission consisted mostly of businessmen and bankers. While supposedly helping the Russian war effort, they sniffed around for future business opportunities. Thompson personally gave Kerensky $1 million to fight Bolshevik defeatism. But when Lenin took over, Thompson left the funds in his hands. Back on Wall Street, Thompson hailed the Bolsheviks as genuine Democrats and boasted that they were using his money to foment communist revolution in Germany. The Bolshevik-Thompson relationship, like the Bolshevik-German one, was based on mutual exploitation. Each had something to gain from the other. For the moment, anyway. You have to wonder, were other factors at work? Secret society connections, invisible and outwardly inexplicable. The example of another American, John Reed, is more complicated. He's still lionized as a hero of the American left. In 1917, the socialist firebrand Reed went to Russia as a journalist. There, he hooked up with Thompson's Red Cross mission and became a supporter of the Bolsheviks. Trotsky wanted to make Reed the Soviet ambassador to America. Reed even wrote some of the Bolshevik propaganda bankrolled by Thompson. But he was also close to William Franklin Sands, an ex-diplomat turned Wall Street troubleshooter. Sands represented the interests of the American International Corporation in Russia. This was a huge investment consortium representing most of the major banks and corporations in the United States. It had a whole section devoted to Russia. So who was Reed really working for? The Bolsheviks or American International? Or did it matter? The downfall of most secret societies is infighting, and the Bolsheviks were no exception. In August 1918, someone put two bullets into Lenin, nearly killing him. Lenin's would-be assassin was pegged as a disgruntled rival revolutionary, Fanya Kaplan. Not everyone believed this, and a post-Soviet review of the case cast serious doubt on Kaplan's role. Among other things, she was almost blind. Kaplan surely was a scapegoat, but whose? Evidence points to an inside job, that is, inside the Bolsheviks. In such cases, one usually considers who would most benefit from the victim's removal. Undoubtedly, that would have been the man everyone acknowledged as the Bolsheviks' number two, Leon Trotsky. That's something another Bolshevik, Joseph Stalin, never forgot. Stalin's fear, real or imagined, of a secret society he dubbed Trotskyism would drive him to murderous excesses against his own party. Shifting focus, no figure from Russia's revolutionary era has received more attention and more mythologizing than the mad monk Grigory Rasputin. Vilified while he lived as a charlatan, traitor, and all-around moral degenerate, popular culture has since turned him into an embodiment of evil. The real Rasputin was an unscrupulous con man. But the rest is based mostly on lies, jealousy, and hearsay. He was never a monk or any representative of the Russian Orthodox Church. Rasputin might have had a connection to a secret religious sect of sexual ecstatics, the Khlisti, but there's no proof. What we're most interested in are accusations that Rasputin was yet another tool of an insidious German conspiracy and their secret society accomplices. Rasputin's chief accuser was his one-time friend turned bitter enemy, Father Eliodor. The same Maxim Gorky who'd assisted Lenin's intrigues also supplied help and advice to Eliodor. He encouraged him to write a book exposing Rasputin's baleful influence on the Tsar's government, with the ultimate aim, of course, of encouraging its overthrow. Eliodor, after being implicated in an attempt to assassinate Rasputin, fled Russia in 1914 for the sanctuary of Norway. There, he supposedly learned that Rasputin was engaged with the Empress Alexandra in a plot to arrange a separate peace with Berlin. In pursuit of this, Rasputin was said to be in contact with a secretive cabal called the Greens, based in Stockholm. Of course, that was ground zero for the intrigues of Parvus and Lenin. Also operating there as a German diplomatic agent was Fritz Warburg, brother of banker Max. The mysterious Greens probably were the Balticum secret society, consisting of pro-Berlin Russian Germans who also wanted to dismantle the Tsar's empire. Their emblem was a green swastika. In late 1916, Eliodor turned up in New York. There, he came to the attention of British intelligence and the same Sir William Wiseman we met at the start of this lecture. Eliodor later claimed British agents warned him that if the plan for a separate peace wasn't stopped, Rasputin would be killed and the Romanovs would fall. And precisely that came to pass. British intelligence itself had a direct role in Rasputin's murder, which took place in Petrograd on the night of December 30th, 1916. On hand, overseeing a band of Russian plotters, was British officer Oswald Rayner. When the Russians' efforts at poisoning, bludgeoning, and shooting Rasputin failed, Rayner pulled out his Webley revolver and calmly put a bullet through Rasputin's head. The Russian Revolution was one of the most important events in modern history, and it was at heart a battle among secret societies. The winners, the Bolsheviks, started out as a revolutionary cult. Under men such as Lenin and Trotsky, the Bolsheviks out-conspired their rivals, exploited opportunities, and rode the waves of historical events. Once in power, they turned a cult into a mass religion with delusions of global domination. Millions of people would perish in that pursuit, and not just in Russia. The world wasn't conquered, but it was changed forever, and we're still dealing with the fallout. The Russian Revolution vividly demonstrates the allure of an elite and the power of conspiracy. It demonstrates that history is made not by the inactive majority, but by active minorities. And there is no better active minority than a well-oiled secret society.